This podcast is free and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
From KOW, this is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. Lush kelp forests are a signature of Washington State's waters. But despite our ideal conditions, Puget Sound is home to just one commercial seaweed farm. That's because Washington is still figuring out how it can walk that line between growing seaweed for commercial reasons and growing seaweed for environmental ones. So how can Washington balance a new seaweed industry with seaweed conservation? And how much of our environmental woes can be solved by seaweed farming? Before we can answer those questions, we need to hang out with some shellfish. Soundside producer Alec Cowan takes it from there.
Let me tell you a bit about the Olympia oyster. It can be found all along the West Coast, but it's the only oyster native to Washington State. And because it's the only native oyster, you might be familiar with a few of their characteristics. Their hard and sharp outer shell, about 5 inches in diameter. Their briny taste. And the fact that thanks to us, they've largely disappeared from their natural shorelines.
They're really dramatically or severely over-harvested in the late 1800s, early 1900s, to the point where, you know, they really kind of ate a lot of the oysters out of, like, San Francisco Bay and kind of moved up the coastline and over-harvested them.
This is Ryan Krim, and he's the hatchery director for the Puget Sound Restoration Fund, a local nonprofit focused on marine conservation.
There's a lot of habitat issues, pulp mills that were popping up, and so there was some contamination in the water that had a really negative impact on Olympia oysters. And ultimately, habitat loss, you know, became a really big part of it.
Ryan is showing me around the Kenneth K. Chu Center for Shellfish Research and Restoration out in Manchester on the Kitsap Peninsula. It's a facility run by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Right now we're making our way through a cluster of buildings that feel a bit like a secret laboratory.
These here are our larval columns. We also have this small system here that sort of is kind of colloquially called a Coke bottle system because it was originally designed using upside down Coke bottles for rearing baby oysters and clams.
How many would you say are in these?
We actually just went through and did a big count, and the total of all of these together is about 900,000.
The hatchery oversees conservation for several at-risk species in Puget Sound. There's our famous Olympia oysters, but there's also a shed filled to the brim with pinto abalone. Those are small snails, famous for their beautiful mother-of-pearl-like shells. And without giving you a full book report, the reason this hatchery exists is because we've reached a point in Puget Sound where our local mudflats have a very difficult time sustaining local oysters. In order to stay anchored in our muddy shores, younger oysters need an older generation of shells to piggyback on. And without those older shells, new baby oysters just float around aimlessly, a bivalve without a cause.
So there's a lot of places in Puget Sound where there used to be dense aggregations of Olympia oysters, and there are no longer, and they're just big mudflats.
So to help restore those mudflats, researchers have to collect oysters from out in the wild to help breed a new generation of larvae with strong genetic ties to the region. Those larvae are then reared in bags of old shells before their destined return to the cold Salish seawater.
So this is a small group of Olympia oyster brood select that we collected from Port Gamble Bay. And then there's another group of Olympia oysters in that tank that we collected from Fidalgo Bay. These oysters that we grew from each of these different populations will go back to those same geographic locations.
So it's on vacation.
Exactly, yeah. They get a little, you know, spa vacation in the hatchery.
The oysters are definitely a little pampered. They get to grow up in warmer water, sheltered from harsh currents and shellfish scavengers, and true to a spa experience, they get all the food they can eat. And if you're a group of 1 million baby oysters, you need a lot of food.
You can see the water's discolored as well. It's because I just pumped a whole bunch of algae in here so that they can feed on that. And we'll feed this one tank probably 200 liters a day of algae, and it'll be crystal clear tomorrow, this water will be.
Oysters and abalone get a steady diet of phytoplankton, a kind of microscopic seaweed that the hatchery grows in these huge, bubbling, 8-foot-tall vats. But shellfish don't have caretakers like Ryan out in the wild, delivering tubs full of algae. And that's because they don't need it. Shellfish have a kind of symbiotic relationship with our local seaweed. Seaweed creates food, and in return, shellfish like abalone help manicure the seafloor for seaweeds like kelp. This is Caitlin O'Brien. who works in abalone conservation here.
They're snails. They're just grazing on rocks, cracks and crevices. They're taking off that diatom layer, so it's like that brown scuzz that you'll see on rocks. But unlike, say, urchins, where they both feed on kelp, the abalone does not take down holdfasts, so the kelp species are able to still populate those areas. Whereas urchins, a lot of times, they can be known to decimate kelp forests. And so in that way, the abalone are ecosystem engineers.
We need those seaweed forests to stay intact, because seaweed provides more than just food. Just like our terrestrial forests on land, seaweed helps soak in carbon dioxide and essentially regulates the pH of Puget Sound. When those forests aren't there, shellfish run into another big problem besides going hungry: ocean acidification.
Washington was really the place in the world where ocean acidification kind of broke the scene first. It was like a big neon sign.
This is Meg Chadsey, an ocean acidification specialist with Washington Sea Grant, a marine research program from the University of Washington.
And there were some real warning bells that were going off starting about 15 years ago, where our oyster industry was all of a sudden really precipitously struggling with really massive die-offs of baby shellfish in their hatcheries.
We know that an excess of carbon in the atmosphere is a leading cause of climate change. But carbon doesn't just stay in the atmosphere. Water actually traps carbon dioxide, and when there isn't anything else to soak it up, the water becomes more acidic. For shellfish, that acidity corrodes their shells.
It's a tough job to be a baby shellfish. When it came time for them to start building their shells, and they had this new chemistry that wasn't favorable for that anymore, and it was just made the job a little bit too hard, and they weren't surviving an early life stage.
In the early 2000s, billions of shellfish were dying because of acidification, and Washington State had to mobilize to find out why. Anyone working in a shellfish hatchery knew that you needed large amounts of algae for food, and marine researchers knew that our local seagrass and kelp forests were diverse and important ecosystems. But at that point, few people were trying to combine the two, merging seaweed conservation with our water-based industries like shellfish farming.
For some reason, because they're below the surface, we haven't been paying as much attention to kelp forests that are underwater.
This is Betsy Peabody, the executive director of the Puget Sound Restoration Fund, or PSRF.
Think salmon, think orcas, think rockfish. All of these different species are dependent on healthy kelp forests. And our own food systems, our fisheries, are dependent on healthy kelp forests. So in a way, we've sort of been missing the forests a bit.
In the midst of our acidification crisis, Betsy and the PSRF proposed a somewhat new idea. What if Washington began developing seaweed farms? The state could lease out plots of water for seasonal seaweed crops, thereby building a new commercial industry, while also growing a renewable, carbon-guzzling crop. And not only that, but you could support and harvest shellfish at the exact same time. To use a pretty terrible ocean-themed analogy, three fish with one net.
I was kind of stuck on kelp as habitat, and I wasn't seeing kelp as food and understanding how that kelp carbon moves throughout the food web. Everything eats kelp, and if everything is eating kelp, from little guys to bigger guys to bigger guys, it's bioaccumulating in all of the species that we're watching closely and trying to recover.
That connection to food was transformative. In Asia, countries have been producing seaweed as a cash crop for millennia. But here in Puget Sound, where the environment is perfect for seaweed to thrive, there weren't any commercial farms. So together, Betsy, local shellfish farmers, and a bevy of marine agencies thought there could be a great opportunity here. If the state could get a seaweed farming industry going, it could help fuel the conservation and restoration of our local ecosystems. Farms could fight acidification and provide a new and sustainable commercial industry. The result of that collaboration is the first seaweed farm in Washington state, Blue Dot Sea Farms. Since 2016, Blue Dot Sea Farms has grown seaweed and shellfish on 5 acres of water in the Hood Canal, and it's served as a kind of testing ground for how commercial seaweed might be used to restore balance in Puget Sound. It's helped lead the charge on a new kelp craze in the region, one that's drummed up enthusiasm around the country. But as the state looks at a budding new industry, one filled with a lot of optimism, how does it balance conservation with commercialization? And just how much seaweed do you need to save our local ecosystems?
Northwest corner, no, a little bit further out. Northwest corner.
Right now I'm on a boat just south of Vashon Island. At the rudder is Mike Spranger, and he's drawing a big square with the wake to show the size of about 10 acres.
About 250 feet, and then another set of buoys and lines that go about 1,000 feet down the beach here.
If all goes to plan, this could be the site of Washington's second ever seaweed farm, and the first in King County.
Because I'm in Colville's Passage, the water just rips through here and brings in a lot of nutrients that both the seaweed and the shellfish really like. And then also, as you can see, there's no houses on the shoreline, real steep bluff right here. And so I didn't have to contend with any homeowners, beachfront people that didn't want to see buoys out in the water. And it's relatively close to where I put my boat in. It's about a 15-minute boat ride. So that's my commute every day.
From the surface, a seaweed farm looks pretty nondescript.
You're not actually going to see anything, with the exception of buoys.
You need big, strong anchors that attach to buoys, which help connect long lines of rope just below the surface. The seaweed is attached on these lines toward the top, so it can grab more light.
And then it grows downward from there?
Today, Mike is collecting some measurements on the strength of current, which he'll send to the anchor manufacturer, so this farm doesn't accidentally float away.
Not very exciting radio right now, is it? Okay, we're going to throw this back in the water. After I undo this, because I gotta pick up my anchor later. Are you ready?
Yeah, great. It takes about 30 minutes round trip to get to the farm and back. And on the ride, Mike and I chat about landmarks on the Vashon coast, waving to neighbors out on their decks. Getting the farm ready takes up most of Mike's time right now. But for most of his life, the ins and outs of aquaculture wasn't on his radar.
I worked as a tech guy in Seattle for about 30 years. Quit that about a year or so ago, about which time I started learning about seaweed. So this time last year, I didn't know anything about seaweed.
That's right. Mike had no marine expertise before deciding to be a seaweed farmer. And there's definitely been a steep learning curve. He's lost out on thousands of dollars in broken equipment. And on one occasion, he had a buoy float all the way to Tacoma because of just how strong the current is through his plot.
There's not a lot of precedence for this, so there weren't a lot of people to talk to about it. But there were enough that I could learn some things about what it takes to grow something in the water as a crop. There's some similarities, I suspect, to growing crops on land, but there's also a lot of differences. The ocean has a tendency to beat up and destroy most everything you put in the water, so there's a lot of work that has to go into making it secure.
But struggles aside, Mike's made it pretty far into this process. One of the first hurdles for new farmers is just securing the necessary permits. Each permit isn't cheap, and you can't even begin to think about farming until you've secured a few of them. Water's a very valuable resource, with 6 to 7 agencies overseeing it. Mike had to get approval from the Puyallup tribe, because they have treaty rights over their traditional use of the waters around Vashon Island. Then there was the Department of Ecology, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Coast Guard. The last agency he's waiting on is King County.
So there's a lot of steps. A lot of the agencies have never done this before. And so they've definitely done other aquaculture, shellfish, but adding the seaweed component was a new thing for them. So they were learning as they were going along.
As for his prospects, Mike is cautiously optimistic. If permitting goes well, he can start building the infrastructure for the farm this summer, with his first crop growing next winter. But he knows he's on the front lines of an industry that's really still trying to figure itself out.
So I'm definitely not going to get rich on this thing. I am doing it with the intention of making a profit. There actually aren't a lot of consumers right now for seaweed-based products outside of maybe your Asian markets, but that's definitely changing.
There's something miraculous about seaweed that flips our traditional view of agriculture on its head. You don't need long irrigated fields. You don't need herbicides or pesticides to help it grow. All you need is a cold patch of water with a good current. It's a win-win for the farmer and for the environment.
The stuff just grows. And it grows like crazy. In about 4 months, you can have a seaweed blade that's 12 feet long, chock full of protein. So I'm not going to eat it every day. There's no way. I'm still going to have a T-bone once in a while. But adding that to our mix of things is something that's got to be done, I think.
You've heard a lot of people so far mention food items as a big driver behind seaweed farm interest. And that's because there's still a lot to be learned about how versatile seaweed can be. While it's great to grow seaweed for the sake of saving our marine ecosystems, you still have to do something with all that kelp once it's finished growing. And food is one of the oldest uses we know of. And entrepreneurs are finding new ways of innovating even the food side of seaweed every day.
Dry it, powderize it. We're mixing it with rice and sorghum, and we're popping it into this crispy, crunchy, sea-based chicharrón with the intention of really bringing seaweed out of the specialty and international aisle and into different venues, including where we are at Lumen Fields for, you know, concessions and Sounders games, bars, breweries, etc.
This is Travis Bettinson, and he's the CEO of Blue Dot Kitchens, which works with Blue Dot Sea Farms to manufacture and sell new seaweed products. I met up with him at the CONCACAF Champions League finals match over at Lumen Field, where he was selling his chicharrones for the first time. Just imagine a Cheeto, but made with seaweed.
I mean, this is unbelievable. I mean, we've been selling products. We've been selling chicharrones for 50 days. So to have that validation where we were brought in and recognized as a product that's for the game while you're watching the beat, while you're having a beer, watching the game, that's exactly where we wanted chicharrones to be.
It's definitely a big deal to see seaweed products at one of North America's largest sporting events. But there's more interest in seaweed past just food. There's some promise for kelp to be used as a kind of biodegradable plastic. And there's a huge amount of interest in seaweed as fertilizer. The more you look into it, the more seaweed starts to feel like it can fix anything.
I mean, there's just a romance to kelp.
This is Meg Chadsey again, the ocean acidification specialist with Washington Sea Grant.
A lot of people come to me and they're like, I don't even care if I make money. I'm like, well, you're going to need some money to make this happen, you know? It can be costly to do these sorts of things, but they're like, I just want to, you know, give something back. So, you know, how can you fault anyone for that?
She's now one of the first people prospective seaweed farmers find when they're interested in jumping into seaweed farming. And there's a lot of interest.
I have people who, you know, who have only just heard of seaweed farming, who don't even live in Washington, but would be ready to drop everything and come here in a second. I try to help them understand that Washington State is very unique, and what they may have read about or learned through sort of seaweed farming organizations or nonprofits in other parts of the country doesn't necessarily apply here. I mean, it's not a completely different ballgame, but I feel like Washington State's one of the harder places in the country to get a permit for aquaculture.
For Meg, that whole rigmarole of the permitting process is actually a good thing.
I think you can look other places in the world where there isn't such a robust permitting process and see what kind of happens in those areas when sort of private business gets ahead of public, you know, sort of public's ability to put the brakes on, to protect things that need to be protected.
It isn't difficult to picture how industrialization can hurt our world. I think back to our Olympia oysters, which were decimated by overzealous harvesters. I think about the butterfly effect of overfishing our oceans or cutting down our forests. These are great renewable resources for humans, but without any guardrails, industry can destroy the ecosystems it depends on. So as the popularity of seaweed explodes here in Washington, how can the state balance the interests of everyone involved? The tribes, the state, the businesses, and the conservationists?
We have the opportunity here for the first time to think about conservation and management and so forth of this resource in a much more non-controversial way. We can get players at the table that we've never had really sitting down together before.
This is Tom Mumford, and he helped pioneer seaweed farming with the Department of Natural Resources way back in the 1970s and 80s. And at that time, seaweed harvesting was largely driven by tribes like the Lummi Nation, who use seaweed for a huge variety of things. But when they tested out some early farms, they got complaints from people living on the water that it was spoiling the natural beauty of Puget Sound, and interest died down. So he's definitely excited now that the prospect of farming has made such a rebound. It's a big deal to get the public, state agencies, commercial businesses, tribal nations, researchers, and nonprofits all at the same table, all helping decide how a brand new industry can help everyone involved.
It's all about trust. We're going to do something that was going to work for you, work for us, and involves everybody and isn't something that's going to be crammed down your throat. And that was not thought about in the mid-80s at all.
An important piece of that collaboration is seeing how new industries can actually help prop up and support something like conservation. Instead of solely relying on government support and taxpayer money, new seaweed farms can help pay into new research and sustain restoration efforts in Puget Sound. Betsy Peabody from the Puget Sound Restoration Fund again.
I think there are ways in which kelp farming can help bolster seed supply, potentially, of kelp forests. If a farm were producing a portion of bull kelp, as part of its portfolio of kelp species and products, then maybe that bull kelp could grow and mature and release spores into the water that would be supportive of nearby kelp forests.
This component especially, of using commercial farms to help stock seeds and support our local forests, is becoming increasingly important. Because it's not just shellfish that need conserving. Our seaweed forests are disappearing now too. In regions like the South Sound and the San Juan Islands, seaweeds like eelgrass and kelp are vanishing. And while researchers believe there are a variety of causes at play, climate change and warming oceans are at the center of disruptions to our Puget Sound ecosystems. So, is it possible for seaweed farms to turn climate change around too? Meg Chadsey says, probably not.
This is going to be hard for some people to hear. Seaweed farming on sort of the, I'll just call it artisanal scale. It's a bad word, but for what I'm trying to say, but smallish, you know, not going to, it can't capture enough carbon to address ocean acidification or climate change on, you know, any kind of big scale.
Even with all the current optimism around seaweed, there are big existential factors at play. There is a lot of evidence that local farms improve the health of our local ecosystems. But if the world doesn't act on climate change and our oceans continue to warm, it may become impossible to grow seaweed at all. So questions abound here. Can seaweed farming live up to the hype and be a benefit to farmers and conservationists? Can it walk that fine line of helping the environment more than it hurts it? Is there enough of a market for seaweed products to inspire new farmers in the first place? And does any of it matter in the face of global climate change? For Meg Chadsey, it's at least worth trying.
I mean, the analogy I always use is when you have a cold, you crawl into bed and, you know, you drink lots of liquids and you do things just to make your body, give your body some strength and rest so it can fight off what's hurting it. So same sort of thing.
Yeah.
You don't have to fix the global climate problem, I think, to do some good. And sometimes small actions can have, you know, unanticipated bigger positive outcomes. And I don't know what, it's hard to predict, but, you know, that's the way I like to look at it.
That story was from Soundside producer Alec Cowan. KUOW Environment reporter John Ryan has also been reporting on efforts by the Samish Indian Nation to conserve seaweed in the region. And just a few weeks ago, we talked with the Commissioner of Public Lands for the state, Hillary Franz, about the state's first ever seaweed sanctuaries. And you can find those stories at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's Teen Dance Ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.